Welcome to the Future of Learning and Work podcast. I'm your host, Spencer Keir. Each week, I highlight the people and companies shaping the next generation of education, training, and work. This week's guest is Andrew Sutherland, founder of Quizlet. Andrew and I talk about building Quizlet, teaching a course on learning at MIT, tools for thought, raising the status of teachers, and more. Hope you enjoy, and don't forget to share and review.
I founded an educational software company called Quizlet. I started it for a French class in high school. So I was 15 at the time, and I was in a French class with a teacher named Madame Salvin, and she had a ton of vocabulary that we needed to learn. And so one night she gave us 111 French animals that we needed to learn, including stuff like la couleuvre, which is a black European grass snake, and stuff like that. And which is kind of an absurd assignment, obviously, but I was getting my dad to quiz me on which terms I knew and which ones I didn't, and he didn't have a very good system for sort of marking them down. And so I realized I could build a software tool that would just ask me questions one by one and do the bookkeeping itself, so it would keep track of which ones I knew and which ones I needed more review on. And I built that tool for my next quiz, and I got 100% on that, and I was like, oh, this is cool. I've never done anything like this before. And so I kept working on it and got some friends using it as well, and they all started getting better grades. And pretty soon it became just like a part of the class. And one thing that was really cool is my French teacher noticed that we were all coming to class much better prepared, and that meant that our classes could be more interesting because we all had this sort of baseline vocabulary where, you know, we knew the terms, and that meant we could have interesting dialogues all together, stuff like that. So that was the beginning. And then I went off to MIT, studied computer science after high school. I spent 3 years there juggling time between working on Quizlet in my dorm and trying to be a college student and take classes and stuff like that. I moved to San Francisco after my junior year to go full-time, and spent the last 10 years building Quizlet and growing it into a company of more than 200 people with offices around the world and significant revenue and majority of middle school, high school, and college students using it every month now in the U.S. and soon the world. It's sort of this strange thing that, like, I had this need. I was the biggest user for a long time, but it turned out a lot of people had a similar need, and so that worked out well for me and for hopefully everyone using it too.
I think that's the classic, like, entrepreneurial story, is that you start with your own problem, you solve it, it grows organically within, like, your immediate community, and then in your case it's gone viral. And obviously that didn't happen by chance. You've dedicated the time to it to make it happen. One question I had, though, is, so it's one thing to identify this problem you have, it's an entirely different one to solve it and to stick with this thing for, it's been like 15 years now, hasn't it? Mm-hmm. So what is the different mindset you had that said, I'm going to solve this problem and then I'm going to stick with it for this long?
Well, on the first thing, I think I was lucky in that, like, you know, I wasn't building as part of a company initially. I was just building something that I wanted, and so my costs were like zero. So I could just build like whatever I thought would be good for students, and you know, let the rest happen. I think one thing that's sort of special about Quizlet early on, which was like not sort of normal at the time, was like it's a totally free product. You could use it as much as you wanted for free. It was possible to use as a single student. So, you know, you could, of course, get your friends on it and you get your teacher on it, and that happened. But it's also individual. It's useful as an individual where you don't need to have it approved by the school district or the some curriculum standards or something like that. Of course, it gets more useful as more people use it and more people are creating content for each other. But there's sort of a really low barrier to initial entry. And I think that was sort of a philosophy I had from the beginning, and that helped a lot. The second part of the question, which is like sticking with it for 15 years. I mean, so I actually did leave about a little more than a year ago. So that's sort of a big new thing for me. I haven't talked about too much, but one thing that that sort of kept me around for so long and that really motivated my time working on it is that the scale of impact you can have is just incredible. Like, we can come up with a new game or feature or new sort of small tweak on the learning games or tools, and within weeks, you know, tens of millions or hundreds of millions of people are like learning in this totally new way. And it's like, where else does that happen? It's so cool.
Especially when you contrast that with the classroom, where you're teaching 20 or 30 students at a time. You can make tweaks there, but the impact is local, and you're impacting millions of students every day. What are some of the more fascinating realizations you've had about learners, about students, as you've been building this company? Whether it's ways students are using the platform that you didn't envision, or maybe this is like flipped a switch for them and they're more fascinated about learning or more curious.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the beautiful things about Quizlet is that it, for a lot of students, they don't have like a system for studying. So like, if you're back to my story with my dad, like I had this kind of system. It wasn't great, but like it was a system. A lot of students don't have a way to study or a way to, they just have never built that muscle. And so Quizlet can create that for them, or it can give them some structure that helps them study. And when they do that and then they see the results and see that like, oh, I'm like coming to class much more prepared and it like feels good, or I'm getting better grades, then you know, their teacher notices that, they notice that, hopefully they attribute some of that to Quizlet and then they start using it more. But just for themselves, it's like, it's a confidence booster. It sort of changes their relationship to their school, their class, or whatever. And if that happens enough times, then you know, students start to see like, oh, I could actually be a good student, and I can if I work hard, if I like go through this Quizlet stuff and I do all the work, then on the other end, I'm doing much better, and that can sort of revolutionize just their sort of internal thinking about themselves as a student, build a lot of confidence, and you know, once you have self-confidence, like a lot can flow from that. So, you know, I've heard a lot of stories of students who that happened with Quizlet with, and of course that's like really gratifying.
The piece that I pulled out of it, that is that Quizlet is really a tool for building self-confidence via preparation. And I think that's for a lot of students who maybe don't think of themselves as intelligent or not being able to handle certain topics. That is the spark for them to get really interested in learning and really curious. Yeah. So one of the biggest critiques about the current education system is that there's an overemphasis on what we learn instead of how we learn. And I think we'll get into this a little bit later with the current course you're teaching at MIT. But in a world where information is ubiquitous, do you think this is the wrong focus? And if so, how do we go about solving this?
So I don't think it's the wrong focus. I think that learning material, memorizing material, is a crucial step in a lot of educational contexts. So back to the example of my French class, like you can have interesting dialogues, but you can't have those if you don't know like the verbs and the conjugations of the verbs, or the like. You need the puzzle pieces before you can have more interesting conversations, and I think that applies to, you know, history, applies to English, like applies to a lot of different subjects. Of course, I think the mistake that happens in a lot of educational contexts is that you don't go further. So, you know, Quizlet could be used poorly if you just memorize a bunch of material, you have a test on where you prove that you memorized it, and then you like move on to other material. Like, that's like, who has benefited from that? But if you then use that material and then do something interesting with it, hopefully Quizlet is like compressing the amount of time and the amount of effort that you have to spend on that part so that you can do more interesting things.
I absolutely agree. They aren't mutually exclusive. You have to build that foundational layer through practice and repetition. And to your point, if you can compress that, then you can get into the later, more enjoyable phases of actually applying that information. Shifting gears a little bit to what you're doing with MIT right now. So you're teaching, you're co-teaching a course that's just called Learning. And I think it's intentionally very broad. So if you could give an overview of the curriculum and the structure, and in particular, some of the ways you are doing the classroom experience differently, like allowing the students to shape the curriculum, the use of the Feynman technique.
Yeah, so I got invited to teach this class this past semester. It actually just wrapped up on Friday, which was fun. And it's a sort of very experimental class. It's sort of a one-time thing. And I might teach it again, actually, because it was so fun. But the basic premise of the class is you spend the first third-ish learning about how people learn and the science of memory and the sort of individual scope of like how learning happens. And then we expanded to, okay, the education system is our sort of society's way of getting people to learn in mass. But like, how could it be improved if it like was more informed by that first part, the like how people learn, the learning science stuff. And then the third part was students doing their own projects where they had to come up with some change to the education system or some new way of learning. And so they just did their final projects on Friday, and it was awesome. One of the cool things that we did is we started every class with the Feynman technique, where two students would present a idea of something that they're learning, and they would have to teach it themselves and then get other students to learn it. And so the idea of the Feynman technique is like the best way to learn is to teach. And so we were like sort of getting them to practice that. And so they got to choose their own topics. And so it was like a whole range of really cool things. We had a student show how to give like a sheep a checkup. We had all these interesting presentations of like an Irish jig or like light photography. And there was a bunch of stuff that like people were just learning for the first time that they were then presenting out to other people and then figuring out like, oh, how, what's the best way to like distill this information so that I can teach it?
I love the progression you talk about in terms of the curriculum from learning about yourself and the kind of the science or psychology behind learning to then, okay, how have we operationalized that within society or through educational institutions? And then, all right, how do we combine these topics and apply it to positive change we can make? And the class in general is just like this fascinating meta learning environment. you're learning about learning while thinking about how to improve learning, and you're obviously at a university. That's fascinating in and of itself. What is, and I think, this question, the timing for this question is perfect since you just wrapped up the course last week. What would you say are the explicit or stated goals of the course? And do you think the students as a whole or on average achieve those goals that you've set for?
Yeah, the goal was to have students think a lot more deeply and rigorously about how they learn themselves and to come away with some new sort of tools in their toolbox about learning, which are like maybe beyond some educational system, just like how do you, when you see something like over there and you're like, oh, I would love to learn how that works, or I want to know more about that, like what's your system for doing that? I think we helped students build a lot of those systems, like how do you take really good notes? How do you, if you want to learn something really well, you should maybe teach it to someone else. Like, can you build that into your life? So there's a lot of stuff like that. For my like secret personal goals, Like, I'm interested in exploring a lot of these topics, and I didn't know all of them super well, and so I was sort of doing my own Feynman technique over the whole class. Is like, okay, I'm gonna like teach all these things, and it'll require me to like learn them. So that was a really fun way to do it for me. And we also got a bunch of really amazing guest speakers. So each class had a different guest speaker where they would, some of them were MIT professors, some of them were other professors. The first class we had Barbara Oakley, who taught the course on Coursera called Learning How to Learn, which is a great course, by the way. It's really short and really educational and useful. So we just got all these amazing people who are like the best at what they do on any particular topic, and like had them come and teach the class, and so I could learn and bring all along the students as well. So yeah, it was kind of a fun hack to do it for myself.
That's awesome. What are so you touched on, I think, two of them, and maybe either you can expand on these things or bring up other ones, but what are the highest leverage things you found you can do in the spirit of learning how to learn? Like how do you speed up or improve that feedback loop?
I think the hardest thing to do is to change how you like consume information. So whether you're listening to like an audiobook or a podcast like this, or reading some blog article, I think your default way to operate is just like you consume it, and then you like your attention moves to something else, and you maybe like best case you like skim off some vague understanding of it, and like it sticks around with you, or like you maybe create a pointer to like, oh, there was like an interesting idea in there. Like if I ever need to refer to it, I'll like remember like what page it was on and like go back to it later. But like that, you just leave like so much on the table when you do it like that, and so a sort of more deliberate version or more deliberate way of consuming information is to like really sit and think with it for a while. So, after this podcast, if you take a sheet of paper or your journal or your note-taking tool and you write, like, what are the three things I took away from this conversation with Andrew? Like, you'll actually have to like challenge yourself to think a lot more about what you just learned. Similarly, like if you, like when I read books, I like write a little book report just for myself at the end where I like, write down the things that I took away from it. You realize that like if you don't do that, like you just actually you like think you learned it, but you didn't. I would say that's like probably one of the most important things. Beyond that you can still lose a lot of that information because like your memory decays, and so the further challenge is like, how do you come back to it over time or link it to other ideas, so that it stays more deeply in your memory? So that's like an interesting challenge. There's interesting research on spaced repetition, how to do that sort of at broad
Sorry,
scale.
I couldn't hear what.
Oh. So that, yeah, that's a like fun challenge. And you realize that like to think deeply about stuff, you actually need to spend a lot more time on any particular thing. It's so easy to just like jump around and like consume a bunch of things, but if you're disciplined about it, you like consume fewer things, but you spend longer thinking about them.
Yeah, that's something I've been thinking a lot about recently and have been struggling with, especially being very active on Twitter where there's an abundance of
Oh
information.
yeah.
It's hard to parse that, and then it's hard to, like, I think I have 200 tabs open in my phone right now. It's hard to parse that, but then it's hard to convince yourself to take the time to reflect on it. And like you said, that's really the only time that you're deriving value. Otherwise, these things will you're just like a sieve and it's just gonna run right through you. That's something I realized recently that I have to spend more time on. And then the point about spaced repetition too, how often do I go back and revisit these topics? It's very little. And so I think there's a lot of learning that I still needs to be done for me in that area.
And I think it's a really good habit to develop. I think one of the challenges at some point becomes like you develop this sort of completionist mentality where like after every book I need to like spend a long time thinking about it, or like I need to after every conversation, I need to like type up my notes about it. And so you have to like figure out where to cut yourself some slack, or like not every thing you consume is like really important. But at the same time, if you consider like, well, what percentage of the stuff that you're reading is important to you and you would like to remember, and like how much do you think about it afterwards, you're probably much closer to zero than like 100. So moving Absolutely. That further is better. Yeah,
I totally agree. What role do tools for thought play in this process? And I understand at the end of the day, they are just a tool. They aren't the end or the goal in and of themselves. But Rome Research, for example, has blown up within the last couple of years. There's other ones out there, but how do you use them and how do you think about their utility?
Yeah, well, you can probably from what I was saying, you could foreshadow that I'm a big Rome research user. Yeah, I've been using Rome for about a year. It's the first time I've had like a note-taking tool that I've stuck with, which is sort of notable and interesting to me. I think there's maybe something to do with like the pandemic, like more Zoom meetings, but still, I think it's a really powerful tool. It is really good for helping your ideas connect. I like wrote up some thoughts for this podcast before the before we got on, and I like linked those to some other things I've been thinking about, and like that's just a process that you get into with Rome that's really powerful. And I think more broadly, like tools for thought is just such a it's in an exciting time right now where it's sort of bizarre that, you know, we've had computers around for a really long time, and we've had a lot of really interesting research and thoughts that have happened over the years, but compared to what the potential is for these tools, it's just like there's so much more we can do, and it seems like this is sort of finally heating up. I think the sort of the interesting meta question is like basically what thoughts can't we think right now, and what tools will help us think those thoughts? And often it's some computer generated thing that like can reflect back to you something that's interesting or make a connection that you wouldn't otherwise see or something like that.
I love that framing. That's awesome. And I think I'm also really excited. It feels like we're at this interesting inflection point where there's about to be a massive boom in the space and the potential to unlock human knowledge, but then also Connor's the founder, for those of you listening who aren't familiar, Connor's long-term vision for this is like networked multiplayer thinking, and that idea of being able to connect not only your own thoughts internally but across different nodes, and the capital and like resources that's going to unlock is just fascinating to think about.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm excited.
Cool. Well, I wanted to shift into a more general section, which I know before we started, you said you've been thinking a fair amount about, and these are very open-ended questions.
Sure.
So the first one I wanted to start with, and maybe there's some overlap between your answers here and what we've already discussed, but what are the top three problems in education or in learning that you're most interested in or excited about right now?
Yeah, I would say the most interesting, hardest one is how do you raise the status of teachers in society? So if you think about it, teachers are not very well paid. They don't get a ton of respect in society, at least in American society. But what if they were sort of treated like doctors or lawyers are in the U.S. and paid well and like people see that, oh, that's like a very respectable profession that like is hard to get into and like you have to work hard and stuff like that. And the reason I choose those is they're also very sort of, for the most part, like low scale or like human interaction oriented jobs. It's not like a software engineer where you like build something once and like it gets used by millions of people. Like a lawyer or a doctor is also interfacing with like limited numbers of people, but having a really big impact on their life. And I think the way we like get to a great education system, I think, is by having really great teachers. Like if you look at all the research on like how students learn and how schools succeed, it's like, it's about the people. It's a workforce development problem in a way. Like, you can have great facilities, you can have great ideas, but like, it really comes down to who is teaching the kids and like who is leading those teachers. And so that's sort of a general thing I would love to work on more. I have some ideas about it, but it's a hard problem because it's like a societal mental shift that I think we need to make.
Can I jump in with a follow-up question on that one?
Sure.
How do you see the role of the instructor changing over the next, say, 10, 15 years with the proliferation of like online learning, also the rise of the creator economy and how that's impacted the development of new instructors? Obviously that isn't impacting early education as much as it is like professional later in life development, lifelong learning. But how do you see the role of the instructor changing, and how does that positively or negatively impact your goal of raising the status of an instructor?
Well, I think there's a lot of awesome stuff happening where, you know, people are putting great high quality content online and teachers are able to reach broader audiences and stuff like that. But I think the reality is that like humans are emotional creatures and they're relationship oriented, and in the education system, your relationship with your teacher, the respect you have for your teacher, the respect they have for you, is really like the sort of underpinning. Before you can get excited about something, you need to know that like your teacher cares about you. And so, yes, you can like learn a lot online, but I think at a deeper level of like raising really good humans, like you have to have people who care about you and who will give you good feedback and who want to see you succeed. And so like all that stuff is great, but also we need like really great people who care about these kids.
And I think just anecdotally, whenever you ask somebody who's really interested in learning or has been very successful in life, what was the impetus for you to go down?
It's a great teacher.
Like, it's always a teacher.
Yeah.
Or a parent that spent the time with
sometimes,
them. Totally agree. Any other problems in education that you're thinking about or passionate about right now?
I would say that's the biggest one, and it's a hard one that I don't think like the Silicon Valley crowd isn't thinking about that much, I would say. I think another interesting one is just like frontier expansion in general. Like we've been, I think Synthesis is doing cool stuff. I think you had them on your podcast, but how do you create more interesting educational experiences with all the tools we have? Similar to this tools of thought thing that we were just talking about, like there's so much potential for like new kinds of thinking, new like creativity in education. And I would just love to see sort of more happening on that.
Absolutely. So kind of in the same vein, let's pretend that you've been given however many millions of dollars you need to create your ideal school. Can you talk a little bit about what it would look like? And there's a lot here, so feel free to focus on whatever elements of it you're most interested in. But I think also I'm interested in what are the most significant ways it resembles or differs from a conventional school or classroom?
Yeah. I'd start with, when I was at Quizlet, I spent a lot of time visiting schools all over the world and all over the U.S. So like I've been to schools in Finland and China and South Africa and Germany and France and like all over the U.S. And I'm convinced by that there isn't sort of one right model, or like there are models that are like super rigid and disciplined that like get amazing outcomes for students, and there are models that are like totally free, explore your curiosity or whatever, that also do the same. So I would start with like I don't think that there's like a, I think a lot of it is just like who are the teachers and do they have like a good system, whatever that system is. So with that said, if I like think about a dream school for me, sort of two more experimental ideas. I don't necessarily have like 100% like full conviction that this is like the super way to do it, but I think would be super interesting to try. One One would be to only hire retirees as teachers. So basically find people who've had interesting careers, who have done interesting things in their lives, who have great stories to tell, and ask them to be teachers. And you know, this is partly motivated by, I had a bunch in my high school experience. My French teacher, actually, the one I was telling you about, she had been a news anchor for 15 years before. And so you just like wanted to be in her class because she like had all these interesting stories to tell. And I think if we could, I mean, like, no disrespect to the people who like graduate and then become teachers, but like, I think there would be something really special if like everyone you were around was just like, had all this life experience, or like could teach you the material, but also like contextualize it. Like, this is why this is important. So that's who I would hire. And then I would experiment with swapping out math for programming and computer science. So I think, are people going to be solving the quadratic formula with like pencils 100 years from now? Like, probably not. Obviously, like, math is amazing for developing rigorous thinking and problem solving skills, but I think you can get at those same things with programming, and it can be much more fun, interesting, applied. You can be more creative, and you can also teach math through those things. And so I wouldn't like get rid of math or like never learn math, but like maybe you learn it up to a point and then you start doing some computer sciencey things, or you learn math through your CS stuff. I would love to see a world where every student was like programming literate, and that was like a baseline, like we think of math literacy or English literacy today. Like, if everyone could build their own programs and like knew how computers worked and knew how to program, like, oh man, what a cool society we'd live in. Like, everyone could tinker with things and could like, you know, just understand what was happening with all these tools that they're increasingly using, and like make better ones, or be able to think about like what all these algorithms and stuff that are dominating our lives today.
I'm on board with both of those. I think the programming one in particular is interesting because so two things there. One, I think kids learn better when it is a multidisciplinary setting and there is some output of that, some kind of project or creation. And you compare the creation of, let's say, a building in real life, which takes years and lots of resources, to building a simple website, which you could do in an hour by yourself. And as a student, being able to see that thing and being able to say, I created that, the encouragement you get and excitement from that. And to your point, you learn so many other things through it. You learn math, you learn logic, you learn organization.
And often like collaboration skills, like if you want to build anything significantly, you have to like get, you know, someone to be the designer. You have to get like someone to build some backend stuff and some front end stuff and like figure out the division of roles, and a lot of things are unclear, and like, yeah, totally.
And I love the point also about having teachers who have experienced the real world and have fascinating things to talk about and share with kids, because that adds to the excitement of there's this massive world out there and it's not just this classroom. This isn't what real life is going to be like, or what the workplace is going to be like afterward. So I'm in agreement with both of those.
Cool. I'm glad you're sold.
Let's get you the money now.
Yeah.
So related to that, I'm always interested to hear about the crazy predictions that people have. So what is one seemingly, or at least in the present moment, seemingly crazy prediction you have for education or learning, and let's call it in the next decade, but if you want to look farther out, that's fine.
Yeah.
And the crazier, the better here. We aren't going to hold you to this.
I think my sort of crazy prediction would probably be along the lines of what I said before, which is like teaching will actually become a high status profession in the next 10 years. So if I like back up, think about the pandemic, think about how challenging it has been to be a public school teacher, or any kind of teacher, how much like Zoom sucks, how much just like change and churn there's been. A lot of teachers have burned out through this time. So in some sense, it feels like things are going in the opposite direction of what I just said. But I think at the same time, people are paying a lot more attention to education. A lot of parents are like seeing, you know, who their teachers are more closely or spending more time thinking about their kids' education than they ever have before. That's partly led to like some pullback from public education and going into more private schools or homeschooling and stuff like that, which like I think are sort of not great changes for society. Like I think sort of great public schools are the backbone of like a good society. But they're like sort of justified changes because like the schools have been like a really rough place to be in the last like couple of years. And so I think hopefully that means that like a lot more people are thinking about how valuable education is, how important it is, how well it needs to be funded. You know, one of the problems with respect or status in society is like it just doesn't pay well. Like if you teach in Oakland, where I just bought a house, like your entire income, literally your entire salary, if you're a first year teacher, would go into the median rent. So it's like, it's impossible to teach in the same place that you live. So like, we need to change that. And I think, as more jobs get automated, as the economy gets sort of more productive, one of the jobs that is both incredibly rewarding and very like human emotional oriented and is hard to automate away is teaching. I think that people will start to realize that more. As everyone's been sort of like doing this big reset in the pandemic and being like, oh, like what am I doing in my life? Like, what do I want to do? I think more people will realize that like whatever job they were doing isn't giving them enough meaning and that teaching could be really meaningful. I think over the next 10 years, I think that change will happen. I want to make that change happen. That's a crazy prediction.
How do you make that happen? What are the steps we need to take? And if you have some secret initiatives going on in that area right now that you don't want to disclose, that's fine.
I don't have any secret initiatives. Okay. I have some ideas, but I think there's some culture change, like some media sort of culture change where it's like most of the documentaries you see about education and teaching are about like some like terrible system that sucks and how much it sucks. I think it would be really cool to have a teaching show, for example, like you have like cooking shows where you have like some professional chef who's like, you know, like Anthony Bourdain, like goes out to like a really cool hole in the wall place and like ask the chef to like show their cooking, and then it's like, oh wow, this is, you know, these flavors are just incredible. Like if you could do a similar thing where you like go to some school and you're like, you like see a teacher teaching in some interesting way and you're like, wow, like that's a, you know, tell me more about like how you talk to that student or whatever. Maybe this is a pipe dream, but I think that a show like that that sort of showcased great teaching and like good education systems could move the needle a little bit on that. I think a lot of people just never think about teaching. Like a lot of smart people I know, I've asked them like, hey, like did you ever consider going into teaching? And it's like, not really. So I think you need to like put that in the water. At the same time, you also don't want to push people into a job that sucks. And to be honest, like the job can be pretty rough right now because it doesn't pay well enough, because you know, the hours can be really hard. Some of the leadership challenges, you might not have a great principal, you might not have great colleagues sometimes. So it can be really hard. So you have to also work on those problems, but it's a little bit of a chicken and egg thing too. So yeah, you need someone to just like do them all.
Yeah, the status and compensation problems are intimately tied. And I think that is the compensation problem is why more people haven't entertained teaching, because it's prohibitive. And I think we would create a lot more competition and higher quality teachers if we raised their income, which is a difficult problem in and of itself. But I think the role of media, and I mean, we are irrational beings at the end of the day. The stories we tell ourselves is like the foundation of society. And so the role media will play in changing our perception of teaching as a career is going to be hugely needed. And even if it is a pipe dream, it is it's one we need. We need people working on that problem.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, in closing, is there anything you want to leave the listeners with? And then also, where can they find you and follow along with what you're working on?
Yeah. Well, I'm on Twitter at ASUTH, ASETH. Also, aseth.com is my website. And yeah, I mean, if people have thoughts about how to change that that dynamic around teaching, I would love an email with thoughts about that.
Maybe we could do a separate brainstorm, like public brainstorming session around that as well. That would be fun.
Yeah, that'd be fun. That'd be fun.
Cool. Awesome. Well, thank you for your time, Andrew. This has been
a lot of fun.
I hope you enjoyed the conversation. Don't forget to review and share, and stay tuned for more episodes.